Welcome to the Ninja Lane Podcast. In this episode, we talk about Asus tablets, the Slate versus Transformer, supercooling, and I check in live from Computex. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today I have Darren McCain. So the latest thing in personal electronics isn't necessarily the cell phone or the Android phone that has, you know, the big screen and watching movies and anything that the iPhone doesn't do, but rather the tablet computer. In some cases, it's just a really big phone, but in other cases, it's a lot more than that. I noticed when you walked in, Darren, you have a new little toy here. What's this?
I did. You know, I tried to resist the tablet rage, if you will, because I'm not really a big fan of the Apple model. You know, that being, of course, that you buy what is actually a pretty cool product, I won't deny, but then you're leashed to that product forever, and sometimes at a pretty high cost with the iPad and the data plans, et cetera, et cetera. So my wife and I were kind of, I guess, waiting for what we felt was a good time to jump in the market. And when Asus announced the Transformer, it looked like the one to get. So we did. We got two, actually.
Wow. Yeah, the Transformer was one of the highlight products at CES this year, along with, I'm going to say, three other tablet devices that they were announcing.
Well, there are quite a few out there that look attractive with the Tegra 2 processor and just a bevy of really cool apps that you can get coming out now. For me, the big attraction was getting the newest version of Honeycomb. And also the form factor. As you know, I'm a little bit of an old-fashioned guy. Even my phone still has a slide-out keyboard. So I wanted the opportunity or the option to get a keyboard if I felt like I needed it for my laptop. And since the laptop is now the Android, the Transformer has that option as well.
Now, at CES, they showed the Transformer as being, okay, this can be a tablet or this can be a laptop. I was under the impression that it came with the keyboard and the dock, but you don't seem to have that with you.
No, in fact, when we first ordered them, we had a couple of big decisions to make. One was whether we needed the 16 or the 32 on board for the memory. Right. We ended up going with the 32, but not per se because we needed it. It was more we didn't want to get a 16 and then later regret it, since the difference is $100, and it's pretty easy to eat into that with an external card.
Oh, so you can expand that memory.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And the second thing, of course, was whether we thought that we could use the onboard keyboard, much like your Android phones, or whether we wanted to get the external dock. Now, one thing that's important to note about the Asus product, and one of the really big sales points, is it's not just an add-on keyboard like some of these USB keyboards you can buy for your other tablets.
Right, right.
What it does have, in addition to just being a keyboard, is it nearly, or maybe more than, doubles your battery life. It has its own built-in battery.
Oh, so you got two batteries?
Yeah, it comes with two batteries, and depending on who you ask, it's equal to or more than the onboard battery that comes with it. So that's a big deal. And it also has a lot of additional ports, freeing up this little guy so it doesn't have a lot of big ports and, you know, dongles and that sort of stuff. That's a plus and a minus. For example, we have lots of external USB storage devices, but as you can see, it does not have a USB port on it. When you're out looking at the pictures of this thing, things that you should notice are that it's got a beautiful IPS screen that's covered with that Gorilla Glass that, of course, we all love from our cell phones.
Right. Now, how big is that? 8 inches? 10 inches?
This is the big 10. I think it's a 10.1 or 10.5.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, you can also get tablets from some other manufacturers and soon from Asus in the smaller 7-inch, which is about the same size as a paperback.
Right. A lot of the people that were looking at tablets said, okay, the 8-inch tablet is like perfect. It's, you know, it's the perfect size for reading and for carrying it around. You know, personally, if I'm going to carry around a tablet, I want something a little bit bigger with some more substance.
Well, my thought is I have a pretty big phone. I have a Samsung and I have the Epic 4G.
Right.
And it's got a pretty good screen. So for me, the jump up from that to, say, a Galaxy Tab, a 7-inch, just wasn't worth the money. I mean, we're talking $300 for, someone's about the same size as my e-reader that I have already at home.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a self-confessed gadget geek, but I do really still enjoy my e-reader. and it's on the list of things that we wondered would be replaced by the Transformer.
Right. You said that this thing's running Honeycomb, which is...
It is.
I'm not... you have to pardon me. I'm not up on my Android letters versus the releases of the OS.
Yeah. So what release number is it? Is it 3.1? Now you're putting me on the spot, and we need Justin for that, right? Yeah, and I'm looking now. It says Android version 3.0.1, so I was, in fact, right.
Who knew?
So things to know about tablets in general are... Really, you can say what you want about them, but unless you're really trying to replace your laptop or your desktop, it's kind of more of a jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none.
You know, and it's kind of like the way people viewed a netbook when they first came out,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you couldn't really do a lot with them. It was just kind of an internet device with mm-hmm. a keyboard, you know, and if it was a web app, you could access it, but there really wasn't enough space on the internal SSD to install any applications to run or anything like that.
Right. So I have a netbook too, which I don't know if you know. I have an Acer One,
right.
And I can tell you without a doubt that the Asus Transformer has already replaced that product.
Even without the keyboard, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true. In fact, the only thing right now that the netbook has on the Transformer is that my Steam games... will not work at all on the Android operating system at the moment. None of them. And so my wife is a huge fan of the PopCap games, which are things like, Bejeweled and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she can find, of course, a lot of generic versions in the different Android marketplaces, but the PopCap games themselves have not yet come out on the Android. So the days are numbered for our netbook.
Now, talk to me about the Android here. Well, not the Android, but the Transformer. It's basically running a cell phone OS, so you can do any of the Android apps.
Right. Now, Honeycomb is the first designed for tablet version of the operating system.
Which so really it just means that it can address a larger space, larger screen space.
That's
right?
The biggest part of it, but some things that you're used to from your phone have changed or moved or are gone completely. Now, in the next release, which is going to be called Ice Cream Sandwich, I believe.
Ice Cream Sandwich.
They're actually going to converge the two. That's the plan, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that you'll have that continuity across all platforms.
Well.
Now, what phones will be supported, of course, remains to be seen.
Right.
But most of the Tegra 2 or newer netbooks will support that out of the box, assuming, of course, that their manufacturers are on the ball.
Right. Now, when you first showed me this thing, you said that there was one thing that you have to get when you get this thing.
Well, yeah, and this is the main reason that people buy a tablet PC, and I will, of course, show you that being the productivity suite that it is...
That sounds familiar. I can't place it, though. What...
So if you're listening at home and this sounds familiar, there's probably a good reason. You're hearing angry birds. And most people have already picked this up on their phone, but simple games that are very similar to Angry Birds look fantastic on the larger screen if they support it. And it makes this thing kind of a fun portable multimedia machine.
Right.
So you can use this thing in my household. The main uses are surfing the internet.
Well, that's mm-hmm. what you would get the netbook for, or any of those small computers.
Email.
And got to have the email.
Email. Games like Angry Birds. And probably last but not least, we stream multimedia onto it from our multimedia server, which wasn't the easiest thing to set up. But it is really cool, especially when the kids are monopolizing the TV, to be able to sit back and watch something from my DVR or from my media server PC.
The wife actually has the... I forget what it's called now, but it's one of the AT&T phones running Android, and she hooked it up so that she could watch the shows she's recorded on the DVR on her cell phone anywhere.
Yeah, and that's super cool. Now, you have to have the right DVR. Ours tends to be an older one, even though it's an HD DVR.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've got to find a way to get that thing replaced, because only some of the formats will work.
Right.
And, in fact, that brings up my biggest disappointment from the media streamer. And it comes from Honeycomb being so new, and that is that the H.264 codec is currently not supported. So some of my videos that I've encrypted in H.264, which includes a lot of internet content,
mm-hmm.
is just not compatible.
Wow. It kind of sucks, but, you know, it'll come around, you know, once people start demanding this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the nice thing, too, is because it's a fairly open architecture still, although not as open maybe as some of us would like,
yeah.
It does give the opportunity for just anyone to develop for it.
Right.
So things to know about the Transformer if you're interested is, one, by God, it is difficult to get one. So get yourself on a mailing list where someone will let you know. But I could tell you that there are a lot of other ones that are coming out that I think are going to be just as good. So if you're not interested in the keyboard, the Transformer is still very nice, but you have a lot of other options available to you.
Right.
And the second thing is, they're not cheap. Now, you could get, say, a Nook Color very cheaply and convert it over, but this particular version was $500, $499.
Well, that's nothing compared to what I bought just recently.
Right, and that's the reason I brought it up. So say you want a portable touch device, and this one is not powerful enough, or you need things like, you know, Office or other Microsoft applications. Right. So tell us, Dennis, what do you get?
Well, you move up the chain and you get the EP-121.
Sometimes called the Slate, I believe.
Yeah, you get the EEPC Slate. It's a 12-inch screen running a Core i5. You can get 2 or 4 gigs of memory and a 32 or 64 gig SSD. And this thing is powerful. I mean, I have Photoshop on here, I have Illustrator on here, I have multiple web browsers on here, I have my development suite on here. Heck, we're actually recording the podcast on it right now.
And it looks great, I might add.
Yeah, it does. It's fully touchscreen, comes with a stylus that's magnetic, and it also will support your gestures, so you can put your two fingers on there and zoom in, zoom out. If you're on a web page and you want to go back, you just flick your finger back and it'll flip back a page, or if you want to go forward, you'll flick forward.
Now, that's not the Android operating system, I'm sure.
No, this is actually running Windows 7 Home Premium, in which case you can upgrade it to Ultimate or any of the Windows 7 versions if you wanted. You know, it doesn't have a DVD. It's got 2 USB ports on it, so if you want to upgrade the operating system or reinstall it completely, you have to get a bootable USB device and hook it in and install that way. It supports Bluetooth natively. It also has Wi-Fi natively. We have it hooked up to my Wi-Fi network right now. But the Bluetooth is the most unique part, because the Slate, one of the reasons that drew me to the Slate, not necessarily the Core i5 and the 4 gigs of memory, but the fact that it came with a Bluetooth keyboard. So you can use the on-screen keyboard that comes with Windows 7,
right,
and just type on that. Or you can just plug in your Bluetooth, just turn this on, and you can use this as a regular laptop.
Now, did the mouse that you're using come with it too?
Yeah, this mouse I got from that guy that we just talked about, his name's Justin. He bought a Galaxy Tab, a Samsung Galaxy Tab, as he calls it.
That's the 7-inch, right?
Yeah, it's the 7-inch on the Android. It has Bluetooth, and he bought this little mouse because he wanted to be able to mouse around on the screen relatively easy. Unfortunately, the Bluetooth protocol wouldn't actually work. I'm not sure exactly what the problem was, but, you know, it's just a little gigabyte item. It's all black and small.
Looks nice.
Yeah, it's not too bad. And ironically enough, it pairs up with the Slate faster than the keyboard does.
Wow.
You know, the keyboard will go to sleep. This is a little Microsoft job that Asus bought specifically for the Slate. I find myself using the on-screen keyboard a lot when I'm chatting with people. That's just because I don't want to carry this keyboard around with me. Now, it isn't as convenient as a laptop.
Right.
You know, it's as powerful as a laptop will do anything that a laptop does. And then some. You have the Slate, and you kind of set it on your lap, and you can kind of prop it up in the case. And then if you go on to use the full keyboard, then you got to find another spot on your lap to put that keyboard. Or use a table and have the Slate in front of you, and then the keyboard right there.
Oh, I see.
You know, so you kind of set it up like a laptop, but, you know, as we're recording the podcast right now, I have the keyboard and the mouse in front of me, right in front of the microphone, and the Slate is actually off to my right on the chair, so we can just kind of glance down and see what we're recording and whatnot.
So what was it that convinced you wanted a Slate?
You know, it was Computex. You know, and it sounds weird, but every year when I go to Computex, I carry around a notebook, which is actually, you know, pen and paper notebook.
Right.
And my camera, and I have it in a little shoulder bag, and I'm carrying this around. And the idea is that I want to take notes as I'm visiting the various manufacturers and get their flyers and whatnot, so that when I get back to the hotel and do my nightly update, I can just kind of transcribe what I saw and then, you know, do the news post or do it as one of the end-of-day articles that you can find on the website right now. That never really worked.
Okay.
As I go to these things, you know, I get invited to little after parties, or I go on a tour, or I want to go out to dinner. I get back to the hotel, I sit down to work and I really don't want to do anything. So it's really kind of a straggle. So I find myself at the show, you know, I have an hour blocked out for a meeting. Well, this meeting might only take 20 minutes. You know, they have a lot of stuff on display and I've already seen a lot of it. So it's nothing really new. But, you know, 20 minutes and then I have an hour and a half until my next meeting. So the idea is that I'm going to carry around the slate and, yeah, I can do real-time updates from the show floor with this thing. Whereas if I was carrying a laptop or a netbook around, you know, it's not as powerful as this, obviously. As long as I have Wi-Fi access or be able to tether it to my BlackBerry, I can, you know, access the website and do live updates whenever I want.
Have you tried the camera on board?
Yes, I have. I went on a business trip for one of my day jobs. And as I was sitting in the hotel room, I went and got on MSN Messenger, called the wife up and, you know, activated the camera and was able to see what my son had done at daycare that day because he cool. went and was bringing over, he saw me and said, yeah, he's all excited. You know, the camera and the microphone are great on this thing. The quality is good. You know, it's got stereo sound, so you'll be able to play music on this thing if you want.
Right.
Since it's a Core i5, it generates a fair amount of heat and the battery life isn't great. You get about 3.5 hours of battery life out of this thing. The thing that I don't like at all, which I think you noticed on the Transformer, is that it is the Apple version of a tablet.
Right.
And then it's all self-contained, and you can't replace the battery.
Yeah. In fact, I initially tried to find a way to take the battery out for one of those random honeycomb lockups that they're working on. Yeah. I don't want to hurt it, so I have stepped away.
Right. Well, when I was getting ready to buy this, they were not available, much like the Transformer now.
Right.
Well, now there's certain ones in the market, but I could not get this. It was out of stock. And that was around the same time as the Sandy Bridge recall. And being right. that it was a Core i5 processor, I figured it got recalled in that batch. But turns out it was unrelated. But there were several people that had cracked open these and were buying the 2 gig version and then adding more memory and then putting a bigger SSD in there. That was how you would get in there to replace the battery, at least in this particular computer. But at that point, you're voiding the warranty, you have a chance of damaging it, and it may not go back together correctly.
And that's a pretty expensive toy in my book.
Yeah, this was, what, 10 mils and some change, something like that? It was either that or I buy a netbook and just sit there waiting for images to resize. And, you know, you pay for the convenience, and you get what you pay for if you get the netbook. So
yeah, and that's very true. And, of course, you can also go a lot cheaper than either of these things or depend on just a fancy smartphone.
Yeah, that's true. I've seen a lot of editors at the various shows that just carry around a little Android smartphone, and that's what they take their product photos with. I'm not immune. I did that at CES once. I went and took a cell phone photo of the Raven case. And this is kind of dating this right now, but
right.
I took a picture of the Raven case from the show floor at CES, sent it to my news guy. He went and took the picture, resized it, did the little news post, and posted it up on the website, and it was within 10 minutes of me taking that photo, it was live on the site.
So it sounds like if you want really true laptop functionality, you're going to pay the price.
Exactly.
And if you want basically a multimedia toy, then you can get away with a netbook like mine.
Yeah, or, you know, if you really want to go the way of the Apple, you can get an iPad, which, you know, some people have been ranting and raving about, and other people are just totally turned off by it. But I would say, given the ones that I've messed with, you know, the Samsung Galaxy Tab, the Transformer, the iPad, I like the form factor of the Transformer. It has about the same weight. It's also in widescreen format, so it's actually easy to read on.
Right.
It reacts really nice.
Oh, I love the screen. I think it's 10 simultaneous touches, the Gorilla Glass. I mean, it's just gorgeous IPS. And I would agree with you. In the netbooks, if you're not looking at an iPad 2, then this, to me, was the no-brainer purchase. And with Asus, you know you're getting a manufacturer with a tremendous, tremendous reputation.
Definitely.
Phenomenal quality of construction. Good warranty, and hopefully a lifetime of support.
Right. Well, and the best part is you're not locked into a data plan, whereas you are with any of the Apple products.
Yeah.
So this is actually a standalone laptop or tablet in this case that you can tether with your phone. You can hook it up to Wi-Fi. You can Bluetooth it to something. You know, it's just tons of connectivity options.
Terrific. And you know, the 3G is coming. Now, ASUS doesn't have that advantage of being already in a partnership with, say, T-Mobile or you know, Verizon, but soon you'll have that advantage, too, of being able to just do it on the road. Now, you'll pay the price.
Well, if they do the same model that they did on the V2S, which was my laptop that I was just talking about, it actually has a 3G SIM spot. You just pull the cover off, you put in your SIM card, and then you have 3G access. All you got to do is plug it in the antenna.
How nice would that be?
That would actually be awesome. I kind of wish they did something like that on my Slate, because that way I wouldn't have to worry about tethering it to my phone. I could just get internet wherever I went.
Yeah, and that saves you the data plans, which was the big reason that we shared clear of those things. Without a very affordable data plan, you can eat the media like it's going out of style.
Yeah. You know, they have the unlimited plans, but we all know they're not fully unlimited.
No, Hank, they're becoming endangered too, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get by that, but in the meantime, you might as well buy a tablet and get one of these.
Yeah, and you could certainly do worse than an ASUS Slate or an ASUS Transformer. Dennis, what the heck is that thing?
That's my single-stage phase cooler.
Oh, okay. That's the super cooler.
That is a super cooler. It's you remember the VapoChills back in the day?
I do. In fact, that's the first probably expensive cooler I have any experience with. But it was nothing like this. It was just kind of a, I don't know, a self-contained unit.
Yeah, well, they're pretty small. There's a review of that, of one of the old premium editions on ninjalean.com.
And that's a pretty spendy toy, though, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, I traded the guy some advertising, and he sent it over for a review, and it was like, it was one of those things, well, I should say the problem with shipping a phase cooler, you know, regardless of the size, is that the thing is big, it's heavy, and it's kind of awkward.
Right.
Even with the VapoChills, they're kind of small, but the case that they came in is actually pretty big. Well, he was selling these things on his online store.
Right.
And, you know, he was also my Soltech guy, so that's how I got a whole bunch of Soltech motherboards and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Well, he shipped me one and said, hey, do a review of this and, you know, let me know what you think. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. It shows up and the box is just haggard. The UPS guy was yelling at me for, like, having something shipped to wasn't even, you know, wasn't in a proper container, and, you know, there's foam peanuts everywhere, and this thing, it showed up, and it was actually in pretty good shape, still worked. You know, I did the review, and it had mounts for Athlon XP and Pentium 4, so I couldn't really use it after that.
Oh, well, that's not a big surprise. Those things kind of, well, they're a little dated these days.
They are, but there is a couple of companies that still make phase coolers, but they make them for modern processors. The Cooler Express is one of them. They were really popular several years ago.
Right.
You know, it's a Taiwanese company, and I think that they ran into the same problem that VapoChill and Acetec did, is that, you know, there's a very small market for these extreme cooling units. You know, and a lot of times when you get them, they're like an undercase unit, so they're kind of built into a case, and then the evaporator hose goes up into the case, and then you build your system around it. I think you've seen a couple of those. There was,
yeah, and that makes sense, because you get, well, really everything you need to get the cooler already installed as one piece.
Right. Now, the coolers are a little smaller, so they don't get as cold, and you don't need to go through such an extreme sort of insulation scheme to make sure that your system stays safe. And that's kind of one of the side benefits of, like, the VapoChill or even the undercase units. Well, the one that we just were running is kind of on the same order as the Cooler Expresses. The Cooler Express was kind of a negative 30, negative 40 degree centigrade unit. Well, this one I had custom made, and it's a 300-watt phase unit that gets down to about negative 55, depending on the ambient temperature.
Right.
And under load at 300 and some odd watts, it will maintain a negative 30 degree centigrade load temperature.
Now, this looks like it could have been put together on one of those junkyard contest shows.
Yeah, I didn't say it was pretty, and I did get it on a deal. So it's obviously it's not going to be the prettiest unit out there. That's a benchtop unit, which is basically just a fancy way of saying that it's kind of no frills. It's not very pretty, as I mentioned. It doesn't even have a power switch. You got to plug it into the wall.
So that seems pretty hardcore to me.
It is a little bit, but you get used to it. And considering that I only use it when I'm overclocking, and, you know, you might have seen it on some of the live streams.
Oh, yeah, but it's much bigger in person.
Well, in the live streams, the camera is closest to the monitor and the system, so the phase unit is actually off to the into the distance. So.
Oh, I guess that's true, yeah.
But, you know, it comes with, I don't even know the size of it now, but it's a Danfoss compressor. And the compressor is actually as big as the condenser. And the condenser and fan unit are part of an old refrigerator, and it came with a much smaller compressor. Well, the guy that rebuilt it took that compressor off and then raised in the new compressor and then added the evaporator line and the suction line and this fancy-dancy evaporator head, which is what mounts to the processor and keep it cold.
Okay.
He plugged all that stuff in and then charged it, tuned it, and then shipped it off.
So looking at this thing, and I guess now that you mention it, I have seen it in some of your podcasts. How does it attach?
It attaches much like a water cooler. So, you know, you take the old Danger Den mounting hardware. So you got the all-thread posts, and sometimes you had a little back plate that it would mount to, and mm-hmm. then the water block would slide down over these posts, and then there's a bunch of springs that would hold it in place, and then your hose is connected to that. This attaches much the same way. I have some custom mounting hardware that I use. Attaches to the motherboard. It has a nice metal backplate, stainless steel backplate, and some all thread that mounts. It hard mounts to the motherboard, and that's what gives the motherboard its strength.
So on the bottom, this is like some sort of water cooler or a maze of some sort. How does it reach the processor?
You mean the evaporator head itself is actually. It's a solid cup. It's a copper cup, and inside there's several different chambers, a series of discs that are stacked on top of each other that fit into this copper cup.
Okay.
When the compressed liquid, the refrigerant, enters that, it actually will expand, much like, you know, those air cans that you use to blow out your dust on your computer.
Right.
When the compressed liquid reaches that evaporator head, it actually will start to massively expand, and the more surface area you have, the more cold or heat and cold, whichever way you want to look at it, gets absorbed into that copper and then transferred to the processor.
So the head's basically a fancy expansion chamber?
It is. And then that mounts to the CPU, and then on top of that, there's a series of springs that kind of hold tension down. I found with this one, since it's not a commercially grade mounting system like what's on the Cooler Express, I have to put it down on the processor and kind of wiggle it around until it's flat, and then hold it in place, and then put the springs on there to hold that in place.
Okay.
Whereas with the Cooler Express, which is actually, you know, it's a higher quality sort of build, it actually clamps around the evaporator, and you can put that down on the processor, and regardless of which way you tighten it, it's always going to sit flat. If I wired it up right or hooked it up right, I could mount this to a video card and just have it coming in at an angle. But it's all dependent on the mounting holes and what I can have put in there. Right now, it's set up for CPUs.
Obviously, you don't just jump right into one of these machines. If I were moving up to one of these, what's a good entry level?
It's kind of a misnomer about jumping into these. Like, for instance, one of the guys in the forum, he was benching a lot of old Pentium 3 systems, and he was using a high-quality copper air cooler that I let him borrow. And he saw some of the advancements I was making using the phase with the Sandy Bridge and some of the other processors that I have. He actually went out and bought one. He bought a Cooler Express, which was actually a pretty high-end unit. But you don't necessarily have to go that extreme. You know, that's, if you buy one new, that's around $1,000. You know, on eBay, you can get them for about $600, depending on how willing the owner is to get rid of them.
Right.
It's kind of a you use it or you lose it sort of thing. And if you lose it, it's just taking up space and collecting dust. So some people are pretty eager to get rid of them. But if you didn't want to go that route, you know, you could go with a high-quality DIY water cooling system. You know, you get yourself a Danger Den block or XPS block or, you know, any of those high-quality water blocks that you can get at, like, Frozen CPU or Sidewinder Computers or one of those places.
So I've worked with a lot of water cooling in my past, and I've never used anything quite this extreme, but I'm guessing the next step would be to add a chiller to your water cooling system? Maybe a Peltier?
You can definitely do a Peltier, but as we mentioned in our last podcast, the Peltier systems require a lot of power.
Right.
And a single stage phase cooler is its self-contained, you know, chilling unit, so it's going to require its own power. Now, if you do a water cooling loop and just replace the radiator with a phase unit like you can actually super chill the water down to whatever you want it to be. Or you could take the route that Coolit did, and instead of using a radiator itself, you use a chilling unit. So you have a Peltier attached to a water block, for instance.
Right, okay.
And then that could be its own self-contained cooling unit. So there's several options there that are kind of a step up before you get to the extreme of single-stage phase. You know, another option that it gets you about the same temperatures, but it's a little bit, it's a little dangerous, and there's a certain amount of expertise that needs to be put into it, but you could do dry ice.
Right.
So you get a cooling container that, you know, would normally be used for liquid nitrogen, or some guys use a soda can.
That seems a little extreme.
If you're on a budget and you don't really have access to this kind of stuff, you kind of improvise. So you can get like a tin can and put a little bit of acetone in there and drop your dry ice cubes in that, and then it's going to make a cryogenic fluid that's just going to make the tin cans cold, and that's sitting on top of your CPU, and that's how you get your extreme cold. But dry ice is a little dangerous. You know, it's carbon dioxide.
Sure.
Can't smell the stuff. You can't really see the stuff. You can pretty much asphyxiate yourself pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that just seems like an easy way to damage your equipment, too, messing with acetone and dry ice when you can just clamp one of these to it. But there must be dangers to this type of unit. What are the risks?
The risks are about the same as if you were to do any sort of supercooling. So you have condensation. That's one of the biggest ones. When I first got this unit, it leaked like crazy. The thing would like frost up, and I had to over-insulate my system to make sure that none of the water would get on there when the system would heat up or when I had actually turned the system off. Sometime after I had it, I went and tore it all apart, and I started re-insulating. You know, I added a donut around the bottom at the evaporator to keep the air out, and then I pulled the insulation off the top that was around the mounting portion of it and shoved a bunch of insulation in there to keep the air out of the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I wrapped some more ArmFlex around it to insulate it again. And now it doesn't frost up as bad. So I don't need to go to the same extremes of insulation, at least around the evaporator. On the motherboard, as one of the articles on the website shows, you need to kind of insulate around the CPU and then on the back of the motherboard to make sure that there's no frost forming, because the cold is going to travel all the way through until it doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Right.
The other danger, you know, it's like if you're scared of electricity. In my particular unit, you have to plug it into the wall because there's no power switch. The Cooler Express that I have is actually a high-powered. It has two evaporator heads on it, so it can handle dual processor systems, or you can hook it up to a graphics card and a CPU at the same time.
Okay, yeah.
It runs on 220-volt power, so you actually have to have a plug plugged into your dryer vent or a power inverter to run that system. Well, you know, that's 220 volts. That's kind of a little bit more power than that 110 socket that you have in your bedroom.
Yeah, you can imagine.
Other than that, unless you're carrying it around, drop it on your foot. As I mentioned before, shipping these things is kind of tough.
So you're pretty committed when you buy one.
Yeah, you are. But when you have it, there's no other overclocking experience that you can match. Unless you go with liquid nitrogen. I mean, this thing will drop down to negative 50 C.
Wow.
You put that on your CPU. I was able to take a 2500K, overclock it to its maximum, to the core maximum, and use considerably less voltage than I did if I was just running on a water cooling system. Systems run more efficiently when they're cold. And, you know, they require less voltage. You can go a lot faster. And that's one of the benefits of, you know, super cooling, or even water cooling for that matter. You can get a little bit more clock speed out of it without a lot of extra voltage. Me having this one custom built and even having to ship it halfway across the country was still worth it, because none of the refrigerant guys around here, even the ones that did custom installations for restaurants, would even tackle something like this because they have never done it before, and they basically charge by the hour, and it's kind of expensive. So having this built by one of the local guys might cost me $2,000, whereas, you know, having a guy that does this as a hobby, you know, I could get away with a $600-$700.
Yeah, wow, $600-$700 really isn't that much more than one of these self-contained units or even a high-end water cooling system, really.
No, and You know, if you were to buy the liquid nitrogen containers or dry ice containers, you're going to set you back about $300. And then you still have to buy all of the other equipment to go along with it. So you could get something that you can run 24/7 if you wanted. It gives you a lot more flexibility in how you tune and overclock your system.
So obviously this isn't going to be running your system all of the time.
No, this is, as I mentioned before, this is a bench system. So it stays out in the garage all the time. When I come out for my benching session, I bring all the gear out here. I bring it to the cooler and set up out here, run it for as long as I need to. And then when I'm done, tear down and go back inside.
Terrific. Well, hey, we'll have to watch for your next overclocking session, and we'll see this thing in action then.
The live stream channel is, well, it's livestream.com/NinjaLane. There'll be a link in the show notes. And the next time that there is a show, I usually post it on Facebook and in the forum.
And that is a great opportunity to not only witness the overclocking live, but to ask real-time questions about what you see or hear, in this case, on that live stream. So looking forward to it. Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, no problem.
For this next segment, Dennis checks in live from Computex. You may notice a little bit of sound quality difference as he checks in from a faraway land. This is Darren, and I am talking to Dennis, coming to us live from around the world in sunny Taipei, Taiwan. How you doing, Dennis?
Pretty good. How's things in the States?
You know, in Boise, anyway, you are missing some beautiful, beautiful weather. First, I think, sunshiny weekend that we've had all year. But I hear the weather there is pretty hot and nice also. How is it?
It's not bad, actually. You know, in previous Computexes, it's rained at least part of the day, almost every day that I've been here, which makes it hot and muggy. I mean, Taipei is, it's a subtropical climate, so, you know, you get high temperatures and also high humidity. And, you know, I guess the best way to describe it would be like downtown Dallas or something like that. But when it's hot like this, you know, the humidity goes down a little bit, and so it's actually somewhat bearable. But still, you know, Boise has a relative humidity of like 20%, and in Taipei it doesn't really drop below 60. So, you know, if you're used to dry and hot, then coming here is a little bit of a change.
Definitely a dramatic difference, I guess, but at least it sounds like it's treating you well. I know I've heard the stories about some pretty severe rain in the past.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the monsoon season, really. So, as you know, monsoons are really, you know, tropical storms that just kind of pass through. And, you know, this is when all the rain comes down, springtime, basically.
So how far are you from the show?
It's kind of hard to judge, really. I mean, it's about 150 NT taxi ride.
Oh, boy.
It cost you 70 NT just to get in the taxi, so that works out to be, you know, like maybe a 10-minute drive. I can walk two blocks, get on the MRT, and 5 minutes later be at the Nangang Convention Hall, which is at the end of the blue line, and that's about 8 stops from where I am.
Oh, okay. I know you have been attending Computex quite a bit, but this is, day 5 of the show?
Well, yeah, it's day 5. I don't actually go on day 5 because that is when they open it up to the public. So you don't necessarily have to register. You don't need to be affiliated with the industry. And, yeah, it kind of gives the locals a chance to get in and actually see the show and see some of the latest in tech. But it also makes it really difficult to get around. And marketing folks that I would normally talk to are not there because, you know, they kind of have just the regular office workers there trying to protect all of their stuff so it doesn't disappear.
Right. Now, I've been following your blogs on ninjalane.com, and I know that at least on the first day, you talked about the initial impression was attendance was down this year. And did it turn out that way?
The first couple of days, the halls were empty. There wasn't anybody around. I'm not sure if that was because the first couple of days are primarily like Computex-related press releases or press conferences. You know, in the morning, there isn't really a lot of people, generally speaking.
Right.
Toward the afternoon, it starts to fill up quite a bit. On day 4, they open it up to friends and family. So if you have a badge, then a family member can get in. They get a little ticket so they can walk around the show.
Right.
That day, the halls were pretty crowded, so it was really difficult to get around. But I would say, you know, attendance was down. You know, if you look at the, Computex reports are saying 30,000 people had registered, but I don't think it was anywhere close to that.
Well, I know with the economy, even globally, it's been a tough year for travel.
It has been. But, you know, they're also, you have to consider that at the show, they never promised anything really new. You know, there was only a few companies that actually announced new products at Computex. Mm-hmm. Corsair being one.
Right.
They released like new products at Computex. For instance, Intel didn't really have anything new. There were some new motherboards that were on display. AMD's Bulldozer system was already announced, so there wasn't anything new there.
Right.
Tablets were the hot thing last year, and now it's just kind of the more mature version of tablets. And there was no new video cards.
Well, it sounds like most of the excitement this year was around the Intel X79 and P67 boards.
Well, P67 and Z68 were the hot mainstream products. Gigabyte, for instance, had the G1 Killer Edition of the P67, or Z68, sorry, in this case, board on display.
Yeah, so I'm looking at a picture of that in your blog. It's a little overkill, but I got to tell you, it's kind of sexy looking board.
I'm kind of a fan, but I'm also a little reserved on the G1 line. It follows a great theme. I mean, it's a gaming military theme, and
right.
A lot of the hot first-person shooters now are all military-style shooters. You know, you have Homefront, you have Call of Duty series, you have Medal of Honor series. It's all military-based. It kind of makes sense that you would have a gaming motherboard that follows that same theme. But, you know, to be honest, I'm not a fan of the banana clip Southbridge cooler. That just seems a little strange.
Well, it's definitely distinctive. I'll give you that. But out of all the boards that you saw, were there any highlights?
The Foxconn Quantum Force X79 board looks to be really promising. The photo that I took had the PCI Express lanes in the same configuration as the Blood Rage, which was the X58 board.
Right.
But I've been told by their motherboard PM that they're going to be swapping a couple of the slots around so that it will support triple SLI and triple crossfire, or three-way crossfire. It has a great PWM system. It was actually one of the few boards that displayed somewhat of a high-end feel for the X79.
Yeah, looking at it, it is impressive. I'm looking at the circuit run across the top, too. It's got to be the PWM, although it's hard to tell in the picture.
In case people haven't seen the photos, the X79 is laid out where it has this massive CPU socket in the center where it traditionally is.
Right.
And it's flanked on two sides by two memory slots because the Sandy Bridge E is actually a quad-channel memory system. So you have channel A, which is dual channel, on the right side, and the second channel, which is two channels, on the left side. Now, all of the boards that I have seen have the PWM at the very top of the board, and then the bottom of it is all PCI Express. And, Foxconn is, they only make one high-end board, and that's for the Quantum Force series. So it makes sense that they would have the high-end board on display just because they're kind of showing off what they're going to have in the market. A lot of the other manufacturers are a little more reserved. For instance, Gigabyte had their UD3 board on display, which
right.
also looks impressive, but it doesn't have that same flair like the UD7 would have had, where it will most likely have the NF200 chip and a beefier PWM and a revised layout.
Right.
MSI was the same. They had a lower-end board on display, and even ECS and BioStar had like lower-end boards on display. So they don't want to show their cards just quite yet so that you know they have chances to change the design and kind of one up the next guy. So,
I see that you've got a picture of another pretty sexy looking ASUS board from Republic of Gamers, the 990FX board.
Yeah, that thing looks sweet. There's a lot of Bulldozer boards on display at Computex this year. That was probably the sexiest one I saw.
I like the look of it for sure. The black and red, of course, is very Ninja Lane friendly. You also noted that you saw some good Sapphire boards there, and I see that you don't have any pictures up yet to tease us with. Oh, there it is. Yeah, it just has a funky name.
It does. It has the PB is pure black. That's what it stands for.
Oh, okay.
This board is extremely special because you know it follows the pure black color theme, supports the Bulldozer, but also they put an NF200 chip on here. So you have the AMD support, and it's going to come with SLI because NVIDIA opened up the SLI driver for this particular platform. The NF200 is going to be splitting the PCI Express lanes to better support multi-GPU configurations, and it basically will be one of the few 997FX boards that supports triple SLI.
Yeah, and in fact, it looks like from the picture, it's got a pretty friendly layout for the slots, too.
It does. I mean, there's plenty of room on there. It was in that case, so I could flip it over to see how they had run the traces, but I'm going to be in Taiwan for a couple more days before I fly back. I'm going to actually try to go out to the Sapphire office and see if I can take a look firsthand.
Terrific. Well, I see a lot of excitement there around Bulldozer on the web. Did you get any more concrete details on the Bulldozer launch?
I did, and a lot of the web people are saying that Bulldozer is going to be late. And part of that is because the motherboards aren't available yet. They kind of want to release the processor at the same time that the motherboards are in the market.
Well, that makes sense.
So Gigabyte is ahead of the curve on getting boards completed. So the rumor is that when Bulldozer releases on its release date, Gigabyte will be the only vendor with a motherboard available.
Wow. Well, any idea where it's going to sit in the performance hierarchy? Because I know that there's been a lot of talk about where they're going to slot in Bulldozer, whether it's going to compete with Sandy Bridge or at a different level.
I don't have any details on that, actually. Although, I think I've seen the same charts you have, and they are saying it's going to be close to the 2,500K range on the Sandy Bridge platform. So, it really depends on how many cores, and you know, right now everything's pre-released, so we don't have any final numbers.
That's true. I had just hoped that there had been some more details released, but yeah, tight-lipped as always.
As always, yes.
Well, looking through some of your other report notes here, I see some exciting new products from Noctua. Now, they have made some of my favorite fans for silencing, and it looks like a totally new design here in your images from day two.
Yeah, Noctua has really done a lot of work on this 120mm fan. They did a lot with aerodynamics and are using the laws of aerodynamics to create an awesome fan. I mean, there's on the intake side of the fan, there's some stepping that actually will create a boundary layer and reduce noise and increase flow. They also added a golf balling effect to the fan walls so that it created a boundary layer for the fan blades to spin in, so there's less resistance and less noise. They've added some chines underneath the fan blades to change the way that the air comes out of the fan, because in a traditional fan, it creates a cone as it's exiting. Well, with these chines, it will direct the air in a vertical column, more focused. Silverstone actually had a fan, the air penetrator fan, that did the same thing, but Noctua has done it with less fins. They've done that mostly to increase flow and also reduce noise.
Hey, I also see that you have some pretty impressive-looking numbers for some G-Skill RAM.
Yeah, I visited G-Skill. Last year, they did a great overclocking show with Kingpin and Chimino, and it was really, really popular. They had people around their booth almost all day just watching these two guys overclock. This year, they had another similar overclocking show, and even more booth page, which was kind of nice. But yeah, the real draw was the high-performance memory that they had on display. The one that's pictured on the website is a 2000 megahertz AMD kit at Cas 6, which is, as you know, pretty darn impressive.
Definitely. Now, I see you posted some pictures from the overclocking, too. Looks like they're working with those new ASUS boards, but how did that event go?
It went pretty well. Actually, they broke a record, which, you know, they, let's see, I'm going to pull this up. They did a SuperPi 32 time of 5 minutes, 33 seconds, and 0.72 milliseconds, which is, as you know, pretty darn fast for the LGA 55 platform.
Absolutely.
They did that with a 2600K running at, I think it was 109 and some change. So they got a lot of people just walking by, stopping to check it out, and several people had actually, you know, won some pretty good gear. Yeah, I have a nice little collection of photos to post on that, along with some flushed out articles that I normally do about, you know, so everything that you saw in the blog postings will be flushed out with some other products and a little bit more detail.
Terrific. Well, more to look forward to from Computex and from Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks, Dennis.
Awesome. Yeah, no problem. Take care.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes. If you have any questions, drop by the forums or email us at podcast@ninjalane.com. Stay up to date and on the latest at Ninja Lane by subscribing to our RSS, now available on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter or join us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2011. Thanks for listening.
Sometimes it